Starting up a business is hard, really, really hard. Your chances of failure are high. You're likely to lose both your sleep and your hair. But luckily for you, you're not alone. Welcome to ET Startup School, your step-by-step guide to starting, building and consolidating your startup business idea. Your teachers at the ET Startup School will be some of India's best-known entrepreneurs, VCs and domain experts. So grab a notebook, pay close attention, school is about to start. Today's class of ET Startup School is called I Have a Great Idea, What Do I Do Next? And our teacher for this class is a person who's had multiple good ideas so far. His previous company, CitrusPay, was acquired for $130 million in 2016, and his current venture is called Cube Wealth. Meet your teacher, Satyan Kothari, founder and CEO, Cube Wealth. Welcome to the first episode of ET Startup School. Today's class is called I Have a Great Idea, What Do I Do Next? Our teacher for the day is Satyan Kothari. Satyan is the founder and CEO of Cube Wealth and the founder and MD of CitrusPay. Satyan, first question, what does Cube do?
Hi, Suresh. Good to be here. Cube is what we call private banking for your everyday busy middle-class affluent professional. It helps people understand based on their lifestyle and their risk profile and their psychology around money on what are the right assets to add to their portfolio. And we find the best assets in the market based on our diligence on quality, diversification, etc., and bring them all together. So it's kind of a curated marketplace, if you can have imagine that, with a lot of self-service using technology, but a lot of personalized hand-holding with our wealth coaches as well, because money is very personal and very important. So this is our mission, to help as many people as we can to achieve excellent financial health and financial freedom.
Satyan, how and where did you get the idea for Cube?
So this is a great question, right? So my previous venture in India was a company called Citrus Payments, which I'm sure a lot of your viewers have heard of. We were processing payments for 15,000 merchants to make your checkout easier on a bunch of airline websites, a bunch of bill payment, e-commerce, etc. When CitrusPay was sold in 2016, it was sold for a sizable amount of $130 million. All the founders, team members, etc. made quite a reasonable amount of money. And before I knew it, suddenly I was exposed to this world of private banking, because suddenly I had Kotak and Avendis and HDFC and everybody else you can think of marching to the door of this middle-class boy and saying, we can help you manage your money. So first of all, I was like, wait a minute, right? Who are you guys? What are you selling? So it took me a little bit of time to understand that. Then as it sunk in that I needed help to manage my personal portfolio, the entrepreneur in me kicked in and said, wait a minute, why were you guys not there when I had less money? A couple of honest guys amongst them said, you know, Satyan, it was just not worth our time, right? For us to service you before you have a lot of money. And you know, being an Aquarian, being an entrepreneur, there was a natural sense of injustice that in that statement that really bothered me. And I said, how can this be, right? This is the lopsided world. So we dug in deeper and we said, why not build something using our abilities in technology, our abilities in understanding what is a good investment from a bad investment? Because let's be clear, even a private banker will try and hawk you some really crappy investments. So we said there's a chance here to, one, not just cater to somebody who needs to grow their money, but also to do it ethically by simplifying the problem statement, by buying higher, figuring out what are the right quality assets based on risk, time frame, etc. Suresh, that's the other main thing, right? So everybody wants to sell you a mutual fund as an investment or stock broking platform. And that's great, but most people forget that that's only meant for long term. If you have money that you need in the next 1 year, 6 months, 2 years, let's say for a trip, for your child's education, you should absolutely not be putting it in the equity markets. But nobody wants to tell you this because they don't make any commission from this that's sizable. So we looked at the entire spectrum and we said we must solve this problem. And this is where Cube came in. So I also wanted to find a space that was somewhat defensible against a big player coming in or a government entity coming in. Wealth tech is very different, right? The banks, as we discussed, are operating at too large and too generic a level to actually try and take over that space. So I think these were the factors that contributed to saying, let's do this with Cube.
Why the name Cube? How important is a startup's name?
Yeah. So if you look at traditional Indian companies in fintech, right, we had our stalwarts before Citrus called CC Avenue. We had BillDesk. We had Tech Process. And one of the big things that I wanted to do when we started Citrus was create a name that could be visualized and was associated with positive sentiments. You know, we have the Apples of the world, which have already done that. On the flip side, you have the IBMs of the world also, which have not done that. They've gone with the geeky name. So with Citrus itself, we had started with, I created the name which meant freshness, energy, vitality. And the logo itself was a nice splash of orange so that it could be memorable. So with Cube, it was similar, saying we are trying to simplify wealth. So we have a very simple visual of a cube element. And cube means raised to 3, of course. So we want to exponentially create wealth for you along multiple dimensions of simplicity, ethics, and quality. So 3 variables that we want to bring in, hence Cube as well. And we love the name because it's simple. People see the sign or they can use it as a generic name, hopefully, in the future as well. I'd like to cube my wealth.
Okay. Are those some of the important guidelines for startup founders looking to name their startups?
I think it's important to try and capture the sentiment of what your startup is trying to do. And then also remember, there's always an element of branding and marketing that you have to do. And I think if you're a B2C startup, you must absolutely evoke something that the customer, when they say the word, they feel good about it.
You know, Satyen, a lot of startup founders, after they're successful, say, you know, I was sitting in a cafe and I wrote it on the back of a napkin and this startup started from the back of a napkin.
Yeah.
I hear you use the word we a lot in your earlier answer. So should one discuss a startup idea with other people or keep it secret?
This topic is a great one because many first-time founders think it's all about the idea, right? And the reality is the idea is very critical. And we'll talk, I think, later on about how to come up with the right idea. But execution absolutely is the key. So the reason I use V is I was very fortunate. From Citrus, I had a core team for Cube. That I really loved working with and I trusted. And a lot of this formulation of what we're doing at Cube Wealth was done collaboratively with them. Initially, Cube was supposed to be a neo-banking company, right? So we were building a software app which would simplify your banking. And for the reasons I mentioned before, I felt like the government would intervene or the top big banks would intrude, we pivoted away. But that pivot was always done in collaboration with the larger team. And at Cube, we have a culture of having an all hands where everything is shared very openly. So we created that collaborative environment from the start itself, from the genesis of the idea.
So what exactly do first-time entrepreneurs need to know about this magical word called pivot?
Yeah, the dreaded word, I would call it, not magical so much, because when you have to pivot, you have to take a big, big sip of humble juice and say, I was wrong the first time in everything that I convinced my entire team to sign up for, investors to sign up for. But it's also very important to constantly be learning from the market and from your customers. And sometimes the market doesn't pan out as you expect, right? I mean, a startup by definition, a high growth startup is a low probability success event. If you knew it was going to work for sure, it's not really a startup. Somebody's done it before. So I look at it as you know, a series of things that could go wrong. And as you start dismissing each probability of what could go wrong, you come closer to the answer of what potentially could go right. If so many things go wrong that your original thesis itself cannot survive, then you have to pivot. And I think at that time, you have to take the hard decision. The problem is, Suresh, there's no scientific method here, right? Because there'll be a big school of thought which will say, oh, you must persevere. The reason you're failing is, you know, you're in the chasm of despair. Only if you persevere, you'll come out of it. And you'll have legendary stories of how the Airbnb guys almost failed and then they succeeded, etc. Versus you'll have legendary stories of companies that pivoted at the right time and succeeded. So what is a founder supposed to do? I think it's a lot of experience, a lot of intuition about it. But also being honest that you are on a long journey for yourself, which involves your family. You're on a long journey because you have a responsibility towards your team members and employees because they've had faith in you to join you and they've taken a risk as well with you. And I would say third is a responsibility to your investors. Why third? Because most of your investors will be professional funds, and it's their job to bet on low probability events. So it's less of a risk for them. They are hoping for 2 out of 10 will succeed, right? But for yourself and for your team, it's a 1 out of 1. It's a very binary outcome. Either you succeed or you don't.
Sachin, who did you discuss your idea with? Did you have a mentor who told you you're doing this wrong, or did you have somebody to help you reflect upon the idea?
Yeah, so I, as I mentioned before, Suresh, I had some core team members that had come from Citrus itself and some that we had recruited very early at Cube. Apart from that, I had very supportive VCs like BNext, Teru Sato, and Dirk out there, who were always open with ideas, with very positive reinforcement, saying, okay, give it a shot, but also think about A, B, C. And I think as a VC, that's like the perfect attitude to not impose your will, but to say, these are ideas, but look, you have to figure it out on your own. It's your business to run, right? You see more of the business than we'll ever see running it every day. So I think this was the group. And then I had a couple of friends who were also fellow entrepreneurs that were very helpful to just bounce things off. I've set up a small club called the Bombay Founders Club, which is a curated group that meets for breakfast once in a few weeks. And the idea is, you know, you just talk about anything you're facing as difficulties and talk about it openly or bounce ideas. And that has really good founders from Haptics, Akrit, to Dream 11, to Mithin Sampath of Cred, etc. So really good people that you trust to bounce ideas off as well.
Sort of a support group for founders?
Absolutely, absolutely. A support group for the good days, and more often than the good days, the bad and the tough days. And this is actually, you didn't ask me this, but absolutely recommend that every founder have a support group of other founders, not family, etc. They're always there, but just founders who are going through the same stuff that they are. All days are hard, but Mondays are almost always the hardest, because reality sets in once you do your all hands, your general leadership meetings, and you're like, oh my God, the problems are never stopping.
So Sachin, you found success first with Citrus Pay and then again with Cube. You're like a 2-on-2 entrepreneur. Is there a particular framework that you use to assess a startup idea?
Well, no, I wouldn't call Cube Wealth a success yet. I mean, we are still in the journey. We are doing, touch wood, we are doing well for our customers, and we are doing well as a small company, but success is a little bit far away. Citrus, I think, was an economical success. I actually had a couple of other companies in Silicon Valley, which I would call emotionally very satisfying and big successes for me in learning and making some money as well. And that's really helped me, Suresh, to create a framework of what I personally use to evaluate anything I'm about to do. So the framework is quite simple, right? And it's copied from many sources. It's not something I've invented, right? It says, what do I really care about? What do I enjoy doing? My passions. Combined with what am I good at doing, right? And this is an important part, right? Instead of just saying I can do anything, over time with experience, what am I good at doing? And then the third Venn diagram element is very important. Can this business actually succeed as a business and make money or grow fast enough because of the opportunity, depending on whether your motivation is valuation versus value creation, right? Very different things. But on top of this Venn diagram, I also have a converse element, which over time I've done after my very first startup in 99, which is, what are the things I hate doing? So that becomes the not factor, right? So these are the things I really don't want to do. For example, in India, I don't like dealing with any domain which has government influence, because I can't predict it, I can't influence it, I'm not the type who will be able to go and meet a politician or an IAS officer and sit for 4 hours to negotiate or see what I get. So that's a personal trait of something I really don't enjoy doing, so I would never do something like that, right? So I think once you have the three positives working in your way, two of which are very personal, passion plus skill, and then the third is like the macro TAM, right? Total addressable market kind of size meets business model. And then the negative element, I think you start coming up with ideas that you can start with as a brainstorm, which is a long list. But as some of them violate some of these other factors, you start crossing them off. You know, I see so many young entrepreneurs, Suresh, who say, oh, this is exciting. I want to change the ad tech world. I'm like, are you going to be passionate for the next 8 to 10 years about this problem? Because trust me, it's easily that long if things are going well. If things are not going well, it's going to be way more brutal and shorter because it might not even have the company surviving. But when things are going well, you have to live with the choice you made of the domain for way longer. Even if you have a successful exit, you might have to continue running that sub-business inside the acquirer's company. So you better care about it a lot based on these four factors.
What is Qube's business model? How do you make money?
Yeah. So this is something, Suresh, which concerns me. Right? I'll be very transparent. Qube's business model also relies on commissions we make when we sell assets. The reason why it concerns me is, in a sense, it violates my principle that my incentives are not aligned with my customers. If I had my way, I would only charge my customer when the customer makes money, makes wealth. I would take a percentage of the profits. Now, there are many regulations in India. I can get geeky and go into them, but many regulations in India which don't let me do that. And so we're very open about the fact that we make money on every asset. And we are like, this is what helps us build the platform and service you.
All right. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I am one of Qube's customers and I have been for the last 3 years. Right.
So, Sachin, how do you define Qube? And hopefully you are happy to be with us.
I'm very happy to be there as well. Yeah, Sachin, so how do you define Qube's customer exactly? And has the definition changed over time?
Yes, it definitely has. So a Qube customer is typically somebody who's mass affluent. They're typically somebody who is a professional. So they have the education to know that they're good at a few things that they specialize in, but also the humility to know they're not necessarily very good at maybe managing their money, right? So that combination is there. So they're earning money, but they don't necessarily know how to manage it. Typically, they've tried investing on their own or through some other channel, and they've had a setback. So then they're looking for a better quality solution. We see, sadly, in a way, the vast majority of Indian households have men controlling and investing money. We would love for professional women to also take charge of their finances and invest for themselves, for their future as well. Typically, they're in their 30s and 40s. As I mentioned, typically IT professionals, media people, finance people, doctors. These are the typical profiles we have as customers.
Sachin, let's change track a little bit now. Every day when you open the papers or you go online, you hear of startups that don't seem to make too much money, let alone profits, not too much money, but are highly valued. Yeah. In your view, how important is A, profitability, B, a clear path to profitability? You may make losses in the short term, but you have a path to profitability.
Yeah.
I remember, I think it was Sachin Bansal of Flipkart. When Flipkart hit $20 million, they asked him about profitability. He said, wait till we hit 100 million customers. Profitability can wait.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So what is your view on both profitability and the path to it?
So I think the core statement, Suresh, should be we should take a few steps backwards, right? And say, whatever company you're starting, is it solving a real problem? If you're solving a real problem, there's a good chance you'll make money down the line, right? Now, what is the nature of the problem? The nature of the problem might be immediate, right? If I can say, I'm a DSA trying to help you a bank account, open a bank account by giving you a comparison website which compares different bank account benefits, you could make money right away because the bank will give you a commission from it. The customer is not paying. All you have to do is spend on enough traffic to come to your website that you can drive, you can increase the volumes. On the flip side, you have companies which have bet so much on innovative technology that has value, right? The famous example I always think from the 90s is when Google said search is broken. I want to fix search because there's absolute value in a human being wanting to search for something and seeing the best quality result in the first 5 results of whatever page they search. If you remember,
and they were the 14th search engine to enter the market, or 21st search engine to enter the market.
28th, exactly. So it was already a market, but they said, let's use technology and software to solve this in a fundamentally different way. And I remember Larry Page's famous statement. He said, when he was asked once, well, Google always shows 230,000 results found. They're like, when will you stop? He said, we'll stop when we can show you one result with confidence. This is the right result for what you're looking for. Right? So it's such an innovative way of thinking. So in a company like that, which is using tech and software and algorithms as its DNA to innovate, profitability could wait. Because they said, if customers trust us so much, we'll figure out how to make money. And very few people know that Google, while it's super profitable today, their ad engine business was bought, the source of an acquisition of a company they had made much further down the line after they had become the leaders in search. I think if you build a business which says, I'm not adding any value, I'm a Me Too player, I'm not doing anything innovative, but at the same time, VCs love me and they're going to give me money, so I keep showing the right metrics to the VCs, but it's going to be hard to make money there, right? Because you're not adding any value to the user. That's very differentiated from the other 10, 15, 20 guys out there. So again, comes back to my original point. A VC's job is to bet and find one winning horse out of a stable. Your job as a founder is you have one horse, right? You better be the jockey who rides it properly. I think entrepreneurs who remember that delta, that difference is, are going to really suit themselves well.
And all it takes is a little downturn or a little, I guess the Fed raising interest rates or some such thing, for every founder to suddenly discover we need unit economics, we need profitability, let's get an all-hands meeting and let's focus on that. Do you think this sort of lurching towards profitability, then towards growth, then towards profitability is harmful to employee morale, to a business?
I think so, because also the systems you build, the marketing team you build has to be aligned between one and the other. Of course, great founders balance both of them, right? And that's power to them. But that's a learning curve that you have to go through before you can hit that kind of perfect balance. I think having a clear vision at the very start of your company, do I want to be a bootstrap business that drives towards profitability or minimally funded business that might raise some small amounts from angels, etc., and then I move towards profitability, versus I want to be a hyper growth company that relies on outside capital so that I hit the right metrics, I think is very critical. Shifting gears halfway, you've gone to mid-level and now you're like, oh, let me go back to something else, I think is going to change the entire DNA of the company. And it can be done. It has been done. You just have to reboot yourself. It's not a fun exercise. You have to lay off team members. You have to go back to your investors and board members and answer very difficult questions. Maybe one or two of your big investors might say, that's not what we signed up for. But you still have to address that. And as a founder too, you have to change your personal psyche and say, oh, I have to give up on that vision, which I personally bought into, and now go for this direction. So I rather have that you have a clear path up front and then only pivot or change only when it's absolutely necessary, as opposed to seeing a deck come from some famous Silicon Valley company saying, oh, now we must shift everybody to this, and keep swaying back and forth.
All right, Satyen Kothari, lots of learnings for first-time entrepreneurs so far. I'm going to now ask you a few personal questions.
Sure.
How much did growing up in a Gujarati family influence your entrepreneurial instincts?
That's a great question. I think the predominant influence was that we were from an engineering family, right? So there was always a question of, can you solve a problem? So not just my father, but my three uncles, my grandfather, we were always, they were always running factories, which made industrial parts, consumer parts, etc. They were manufacturing them. You know, the typical Gujarati stereotype is of a dalal, a broker, right, or a trader, which is very much focused on the bottom line, making money. I think we were engineers first, and in some cases, like my father, engineers only. He was not very good at marketing. Some of my uncles were much better at that. So I think the entrepreneurial gene was there, but it wasn't a complete gene. And I also personally really suffered from not knowing how to do marketing, sales in my first startup. And that's when it did not work as well as I wanted. So I went back to the drawing board. But of course, that Kida was there of saying, always be your own boss. I think being in the US first, when I got there, I was so happy I made it there, right? Like every Indian middle-class boy saying, okay, escape. Now the vision is to live in the suburbs in a garage with two cars. But I think for me, that vision lasted for maybe 2 years. And then it was just like, come on, this is not enough. I want to be my own boss. There are enough problems to solve. I have the right credentials, the right knowledge, the right hunger. And that's definitely the DNA coming from either Gujarati family or an engineering family or both.
Both. So Gujarati and engineering, the confluence of the two, to use your Ikigai model. Satyen, entrepreneurship is said to be a lonely, difficult journey. Did entrepreneurship extract a cost on your personal life?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think this is one of the biggest things as a first-time entrepreneur I would give some advice on, right? That you have to be passionate about it. There's no ways, right? The number of problems you'll solve on a given day is just insane. Everything from hiring to why the hire didn't show up to there's a problem between these two employees to the software is not working, AWS is billing us too much, to people are complaining that the office coffee sucks, what should we do, right? It's the entire spectrum. Having said that, you know, I made the big mistake of letting my personal life suffer a lot in my first startup, from working long hours to missing, you know, very memorable events like my two best friends' weddings I missed in India because I thought my work as an entrepreneur, being a first-time founder in Silicon Valley, was so important that I couldn't spare 5 days to fly out for a wedding. And you know, these are memories or occasions or situations that never come back. So I think it's very important to keep that balance of saying you need to be healthy, both physically, mentally, emotionally, to do your best job as an entrepreneur. So whether it's setting up a routine for yourself of, I won't go as far as the crazy Silicon Valley guys who say, oh, 4 a.m. I wake up and I go for a 1 hour jog and then I meditate and I do push-ups and my green smoothie. I mean, we are not robots, right? I hope that's not how we all want to live. But keep a balance for yourself, keep a balance for your family, especially if you have children, you know, that's the time you're never going to get back with your children as they're growing up. So where's the healthy balance? And almost every second time entrepreneur I know has a much better work-life balance. And many first-time entrepreneurs say, oh, that's because you already achieved success. No. Even if they was not successful, they've realized when the journey ends in hindsight, how messed up they were in not having that balance.
Satyan Kothari, thank you very much for being part of ET Startup School.
Suresh, thank you so much for this. You know, I have to say to your audience, it's because it was Suresh asking that I wanted to do this, because the questions are always deep, intelligent, and positively inclined. And my last parting words to entrepreneurs is just that it's an amazing journey. I wouldn't choose any other life path, but just be very, very deliberate in what you pick to do, because it takes up so much of your life energy. And it's okay to fail multiple times. I didn't taste real, real big financial success as the media recognizes it till my fourth startup. But I enjoyed the journey even in the first three, I would argue maybe even more so in the second and the third one, because I kept learning about what mattered most to me. So hopefully all of you change the world in a small way, as Steve Jobs says, you know, put a dent in the universe. Hopefully we all make the world a little bit better because of that.
So that brings us to almost the end of today's class at ET Startup School. If you'd like to be a good student, check out and do the homework assignment in the show notes. If you like the podcast, share it with family, friends, even your frenemies. ET Startup School is produced by Animesh Das, with inputs from Anupriya Nair, Erika D'Souza, Arijit Burman, Shilpa Sharma, Harish Shavla, Govind Mundra, and Vishal Bhandari. ET Startup School is available on economictimes.com and ET Play, as well as Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, JioSaavn, and Google Podcasts.